special Friday edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast. Got another thriller in Oklahoma City that the Spurs took this time. Also going to talk about Cleveland grabbing an insurmountable 3-0 lead against Atlanta, and also a little bit of news at the end as well. We're presented today by our friends at SeatGeek, and joining me as often, Danny LaRue.
Let's get to it.
So the number one story, of course, you can get from this game can be gleaned simply from the box score, in which Russell Westbrook took 31 shots and had 31 points on 35 shooting possessions overall with his 8 free throws. Actually, 34 shooting possessions because he had a couple of and ones. And then Durant, 26 points on 18 field goal attempts and 6 free throws attempted. Do you make much of this? What can we take away from this? Obviously, a lot of people are saying Russ shot too much. He himself even said he took too many shots and he's got to get others involved in the post game. What say you to all that?
He did take too many shots, but that's part of what the Spurs were conceding. I would argue intelligently that the Spurs were making it more open for Russ, and he is somebody who takes those shots. And the 31 is a lot, but for me, the more egregious aspect of that is that the Oklahoma City Thunder took 33-point shots in this game. 5 of those came from Kevin Durant.
Yeah, Russ took 10 threes. He was 5 out of 17 on uncontested shots in this one. And so they were giving him that shot. The Spurs did a lot more switching than we had seen before defensively, meaning that Russ was able to go one-on-one. But then what the Spurs also were doing was pinching into the middle with their wings, both on KD and on Russ, and just packing the paint. And so the shot that was there a lot of times for Russ was the three-pointer, especially a lot of times with the clock running down, or, you know, mid-range twos, which he was also 0-for-4 on. And then at the rim, even he struggled as well, relatively. He was 7 out of 16, which is a little disappointing when you consider how many of his shots are in transition, and the fact that Tim Duncan, who's really the only legit rim protector on the Spurs, only played 14 minutes.
Yeah, it is definitely concerning. San Antonio was the fourth best team in the league in terms of restricted area field goal percentage, defensive field goal percentage. But Russ, you know, he's going to have to do better than that. And as you pointed out, you know, being 7 of 16, let's say they were all in, you know, in contested sets or something like that, that would be not great. I don't think it would be horrendous. But when you consider that a few of those were just, you know, dunks or layups in transition, that really does, that inflates the number to a number that looks a lot worse in that context.
Yeah, Russ has never been the most creative finisher. His strategy is just to go a million miles an hour, and it works for him because he generates so many shots at the rim. I mean, 16 shots at the rim in a game for a point guard is unbelievable out of his 31. But part of the way that he generates that is that he goes just a million miles an hour to the basket, and he's always going so fast that he can't really lay it up with any touch. Most of his shots carom too hard off the backboard, and that's why they don't go in, especially when there's a reasonable contest there. So that's part of the problem. I still think, though, that the other part of the problem is simply that the rest of the Thunder shot 14 out of 33. They did not shoot well on three-pointers, other than Serge Ibaka, who was 5 out of 6, but that was 6 of his 8 shots were threes as well. You know, he just really did not do much of anything at all. And there was nobody else who really was able to do much. Robertson, when he played, you know, wasn't being guarded at all, and he took 1 three-pointer. He had a drive for a dunk and an alley-oop dunk along the baseline was the one play. And the Spurs will happily take that for 26 minutes of not having to guard him at all. Deion Waiters, 2 out of 6, 1 out of 3 on threes. I mean, he just, you know, rarely touches the ball, and when he does, he's not really a threat to score at the rim. He'll often turn it over as well on his drives, or, you know, isn't going to find the open man, so they're not worried about leaving him at all. And it ends up adding up. You know, Campaign was 0-for-4 on threes. All of them were pretty much open. You know, he took some pretty ugly twos, and had a couple of really ugly turnovers. That didn't help much either to give some playmaking when Russ was out of the game.
Well, and one thing I want to add is that you taking bad shots is, of course, a problem, but also not taking any shots is a problem too. Steven Adams was in the game for 41 minutes and took 1 shot from the field.
Yeah, and the reason for that was they switched that pick and roll a lot more, especially when Duncan was out of the game. For the times when Aldridge was guarding Adams, they were okay switching Aldridge onto Russ and even onto KD early on. And then, you know, the backside wing or whoever it was always just happy when they didn't switch it to get right in there and block that nice alley-oop pass with Russ and Steven Adams have like some pretty good chemistry, and Adams wasn't able to be that much of a factor on the offensive glass either. You know, he got a 3, which was decent, but, you know, not enough to really where they killed it on second chance points. So, yeah, it was this offense, as it always has been, is not diversified enough. And I think really the most disappointing aspect of that to me is Ibaka, a guy who we've seen can put the ball on the floor on occasion, can hit a nice mid-range 2. They don't really use him in pick and pop that much. Yeah, he can hit some spot up 3s, and he was very, very effective on those, going 5 out of 6. But aside from that, he's just not involved. He's just standing in the corner, and he's a guy who I think could do more theoretically if, you know, they had weaned him into being a part of the offense, had him handle the ball, you know, and this is a 5-6 year thing where he just never touches the ball unless he's wide open for a jump shot or a dunk.
And that's why he drags out to the 3-point line, because it's more likely he's going to get an open shot there than if he's a little bit closer. And it's also hard because it's rare to find a true big man that is a respectable threat on the pop and the roll, because it's just harder as a defender because he could go either direction. And so those guys are very valuable if you can use them well, and Oklahoma City just doesn't.
Another disappointment, too, is that KD just does not get open. I mean, the fact that he was able to be efficient the way he was, and he took a mere 4 uncontested shots the whole night, was 2 out of 4 on those. That's crazy. They just don't do enough to get him open. There aren't enough threats to where you're ever going to leave him.
Also, he doesn't fight enough for it. I mean, there was the possession that Seth got Matt on, and I agree with him, where Kyle Anderson was on him. Why Kyle Anderson was in the game with about 4 minutes to go, I don't understand. But he had that, and when you have Kyle Anderson on you, if you're as good as Kevin Durant, that is a time to push.
Yeah, it was interesting, just his body language, both of those plays. Now, on those two plays in question, the process was absolutely terrible. That was when they went up by 4. The process was absolutely terrible, but they got 2 threes out of it. One was Russ, terrible shot, offensive rebound, and then throw it out to Ibaka. And the other one was a Russ step back 3 at the end of the clock after they tried to post up Deion Waiters on Tony Parker instead of giving it to Durant. And Durant was sort of like kind of holding his hand up, but like not really for both those possessions. But it wasn't like Anderson was full on denying him. On the first play, especially, Russ could have just thrown it to him and he just didn't. So that was part of it too. But again, I mean, even then, so your offense says, all right, we're just going to give it to him and he's going to go one on one. And then against the set defense, there still should be more options. This is an all-time great defensive team, and you're just going to struggle to score against them like that. I think another concern as well was Ibaka, just his lack of activity. I thought, I mean, now he did an okay job. He had to fight Aldridge. That's very tiring. And they actually held Aldridge to, you know, they followed him a fair amount, but they held him down okay. He was only 8 out of 21 from the field. So Ibaka did well on him. But he wasn't able to make his effort felt elsewhere. He's been had a very poor rebounding season. If you just count the number of times that he just jumps throughout the game, whether it's blocking shots, whether it's, you know, going for the hitting the offensive glass, whether it's jumping for defensive rebounds, like that key offensive rebound that Kawhi had, Steven Adams had to get out to contest LaMarcus, and Ibaka just never moved, didn't try to box out Kawhi, didn't follow the ball, didn't try to jump at all. You know, he was the one big man who was down there. It was really, you know, a disappointing performance from him, just in terms of like imposing his physical will and athleticism on the game. That's something that's the way for the Thunder to win this game. And, you know, they just weren't able to do enough of that.
And he played 36 minutes, which is a lot, but it was also less than 3 other starters, Durant, Westbrook, and Steven Adams. So you have to wonder if, you know, what really does that, you know, if it's possible that he can't play at that activity level for 36 minutes, then you'd rather have him play 30 or 31. But if it's something more structural, or just that he's just not that guy right now, that's a much bigger concern.
Another concern, we talked about the missed Russ layups, especially in transition. He always falls down afterwards. He always complains for a call afterwards. And he always doesn't sprint back on defense afterwards. And the Spurs really just roasted them. Their only good offense for a lot of this game, and the Thunder D I thought was pretty good in the aggregate, their only good offense was running in transition after a Russ missed layup. You know, I would love to know how many points they scored after Russ missed layups. I didn't track it personally, but I think there were probably at least like 6 or 7 buckets that they got that way.
Yeah, and we talk about, it was something we discussed a couple days ago about how missed layups are actually more devastating for a defense, but you exacerbate that problem with the issue that Miami ran into for years with Wade. The Clippers run into this too, where that guy takes himself out of the play further than he needed to.
We've been remiss in going this far without talking about what was an excellent Spurs performance on the road, very tough environment. Kawhi Leonard, with his 31 points and 11 rebounds, including that key offensive rebound, we talked about extremely efficient, 9 out of 17, 3 of 4 from 3 when, you know, some of the Thunder defensive errors letting him just get a wide open threes were pretty bad. And then 10 of 14 from the line. You know, he got to the line quite a bit as well. The Spurs and he, in conjunction, solved the issue with Deion Waiters. Waiters had been effective on him because he'd been trying to attack facing up off the dribble from the perimeter, and Waiters was able to cut him off and was strong enough to not get back down there. So what they went to instead was setting screens, usually with LaMarcus, because Serge Ibaka did not want to leave LaMarcus open to help. And then Kawhi was able to get the ball right down on the block, shoot it right over Waiters, use pump fakes and craft to get to the foul line on Waiters. And same thing with Robertson. Well, Robertson actually did a better job on Kawhi, I thought, than he had in the first two games. But, you know, Kawhi was just too much to deal with. That was the main scoring threat for the Spurs, with LaMarcus held in check just a little bit more. And then Tony Parker was scoring, but that was all just on spot-ups when they weren't guarding him.
Yeah, they were just letting him go. And Parker is not, you know, he's had his spot-up moments, but he's not a three-point shooter. So in this game, he was 3 of 6.
From the corner, I think he is. I would not be excited to leave him.
He
in the
can
corner,
do it. He just break. Doesn't. Like, that's the thing. So this was the first time that he has attempted 6 threes in a game, any game, regular season, playoffs, whatever, since April 19th, 2004.
Wow, that's pretty remarkable, and that was emblematic of kind of what the strategies for both teams were. You know, it was a lot of post-ups for LaMarcus and Kawhi, and then it was, hey, Tony, go chill in the opposite corner. They brought a ton of help over, and unlike in Game 2, they were actually able to find Parker, and for him, you know, all three of his made threes were corner threes.
And something I know you wanted to talk about that I should have brought this up when we were talking about Kawhi is the way that Popovich used minutes in this game. So Kawhi played 39, which is a lot, and LaMarcus played 44.
Yeah, and I asked you, I was like, that's got to be, you know, given Pop's reputation, the most minutes any of his players has played it in a while. What was the answer to that?
The last time a Spur played 44 minutes or more was Game 7 of the 2013 NBA Finals, so the game after Ray Allen shot, Kawhi played 45 minutes.
Yeah, and he was, I'm sure, guarding LeBron pretty much that entire time by then. And, yeah, I thought that they actually could have played Tim Duncan a little bit more, especially down the stretch. One way I think that they could get some more mileage out of Duncan defensively is whenever Robertson is in the game, they just go give Robertson the Tony Allen treatment and have Duncan, you know, which we call it that because that's what the Warriors did with Andrew Bogut on Tony Allen last year. Robertson might even be less threatening at this point from the perimeter than Tony Allen is. So you could have Duncan guard him, and then you would still keep LaMarcus, could probably guard Steven Adams, and then you would have a wing guard Ibaka. Ibaka's not going to post up. You'll be fine there. And if it is, Duncan will be right there for the help anyway. Same thing with LaMarcus and pick and roll. If they want to roll Adams to the rim, fine. Tim Duncan will just be standing right there to stop him and make him throw it to the corner to Robertson. Even if Robertson wants to get his alley-oops, Duncan's always going to be close to the basket. He's not going to, you know, kind of let his attention waver. I think that would be a great way to get some more mileage out of Duncan, because you know Duncan is just the perfect antidote for Russ, because he's not going to foul. He's always going to be in position, and he's just going to force Russ to miss these layups without letting him get to the foul line. So I think they could get a little bit more out of Duncan. Maybe don't have to play Aldridge quite as many minutes. I thought he wore down a little bit by the end of the game offensively. But nonetheless, I appreciated Pop being willing to go for it. And the other thing, too, is that with Kawhi, he went to really just, you know, it wasn't your normal NBA rotation, okay, sit out, you know, for 6 minutes or whatever and come back in. He just took him out whenever, usually when KD was out, but for a couple times when he wasn't, and just let him get a blow real quick before a timeout and then come back in. I thought that was great. That's what more coaches should do with their stars, because that's how the human body recovers, is, you know, you sit for 5 minutes and you're ready to go again. There's no point in sitting another 10 minutes after you've already recovered. So I thought that was a great way to do it with Kawhi, and it kept him fresh towards the end while still allowing him to play 39 minutes, and he had a ton of energy and made some big energy plays late.
In his last 5 playoff games, Andre Robertson has scored a total of 12 points. And all of those games he played 20 minutes or more, most of them he played 25 minutes or more. So he is a complete non-threat out there. And during that time, he has made exactly 0 three-point shots. So I think the idea of Tony Allen-ing him is
He's hit the backboard on 2 corner three-pointers, I think, as well.
The side of the backboard.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, that's the only way to hit it when you shoot it from the corner.
Didn't Curry bank a 3 from the corner once recently?
Yeah, you know, he kind of gets a little more benefit of the doubt for me, though, as it turns out.
Maybe for a decent reason.
What else do you have? Any other kind of macro thoughts before we talk about the end of this game?
I think that there is this running issue with Oklahoma City that they don't trust, you know, any of their shooting guard options. But I think that Waiters pretty clearly played the best of any of them today.
I guess so. I would actually, I mean, the problem with KD on Kawhi, I think he actually can do one of the best jobs because he's just so long that even if Kawhi bumps him backwards, KD can still contest his shot. And he got a couple of nice ones on there. But there's another play where KD was guarding him and Kawhi just popped out to the three-point line. There wasn't really much resistance and KD just sort of didn't follow him and he shot a three that he made, of course, because Kawhi Leonard shoots 47% on threes or whatever it is. I would like to see Oklahoma City because their problem in the series is still probably scoring. I think they've done a really good job of fixing their defense. They've taken away the LaMarcus pick and pops pretty well now at this point that so bedeviled them in that first game. That give KD some minutes on Kawhi. You know, it's going to tire him out a little bit more, but that's, you know, you deal with that because then you can play Morrow, have him guard Danny Green, and you make everyone's life easier on offense. And you know, it is kind of a shame that they just don't even have anyone. Like, you can't just, like, run a couple of plays where you run Morrow off a screen or two, like, just to vary it up, like, a little bit. You know, let the defense deal with something that they haven't seen. I mean, that was the other thing, too. I thought that the Spurs were all over every single ATO that Billy Donovan ran in this game.
One other thing I wanted to mention was how much Oklahoma City's, I don't want to call it a second unit because I believe Durant was out there for most of it, how much that lineup that closed particularly the first quarter struggled on offense.
Donovan went in the complete opposite direction as game two, probably warranted because that unit with Morrow, Payne, KD, Waiters, and Cantor got blitzed in game two. So, and the Cantor and Adams together lineup did pretty well, and they were able to get on the offensive glass a little bit with that lineup, but they weren't really able to score that well during that period either. You know, it's still, they have been staggering KD and Russ. I think, still think that that's a good way to go, but they weren't able to score with that, and I don't know that there are really any great answers when it's only one of the two of them on the floor. I mean, they struggle badly enough even when they're both out there.
Yeah, can you think of a solution?
with the current roster? I think I would just try to play Morrow more and see if that really helps and see if you can get him involved. I mean, I think things like, you know, pick and pops, and you know, you can't install like a Warriors style, you know, move the ball from side to side offense before game four, but I definitely think that Morrow, who probably will be guarded by Parker, pick and pops to get him onto Russ, and then Russ can go into the post. Same thing with KD, and you know, make Tony Parker guard someone who is a threat, and then, you know, if you can get to your kind of isolation game on Parker a little bit, or, you know, hopefully get some open threes, and or just have more of the floor spaced out with Morrow, a guy that they at least are going to guard. I mean, he played, you know, 3 minutes, he missed one shot, and then Donovan took him out. So that's about all I've got. But again, the problem there is same as with Campaign, who was awful in this game, had just so many mistakes, both with the ball in his hands, another one where at the end of the third quarter, he was just like they ran a pick and roll that would have been wide open. And Campaign, for some reason, was like standing in the dunker spot, just letting his man Ginobili break up that pass for no reason instead of spacing out, just didn't know where to be. You know, if he'd been playing these last 30 games, maybe he wouldn't be making those mistakes. If Morrow had some time to get more of a look and they didn't just say, well, he just can't do it, he can't defend, we're not going to bother anymore, and it doesn't matter that we don't have anyone else who can shoot, we're just going to bury him, and now, oh yeah, man, now we need him, but he's totally out of practice.
Yeah, look at Miami. Miami had guys that they weren't really confident in. They gave him some time. Richardson, I think, was more, his game was more conducive to contributing early on, but still, they gave him a shot.
Yeah. Let's talk about the end a little bit here. We don't need to necessarily go through from possession to possession. One play that was pretty telling, that was a key one. I think the Spurs, it was 85-81, and the Spurs went on a 10-0 run. And a key play in that was to get them back up. Tony Parker came down in transition, and Steven Adams kind of picked him up. There was a screenshot of four Thunder players pointing, and no one really getting out on him. And then Russ was stuck under the basket with whoever Adams was guarding, and Adams just never went out there. Everyone was pointing for him to go out there, and he never did. And Parker just hit a wide open 22-footer, and then Russ yelled at him afterwards. You know, that was sort of a rough play. I mean, not something that you necessarily is in your DNA as a center to get out and guard Tony Parker 22 feet from the basket. But probably, I mean, it was pretty obvious that he was the only one who was in position to do it.
And then one of the big stories for me in this game was the ball movement by the Spurs, but particularly David West. And I love the fact that when he's basically in pass mode, when he doesn't have a clean look at a shot, the ball moves so quickly out of his hands and it creates looks for other guys.
Yeah, the Spurs, it's a ton of ISO ball for them now. I mean, let's be honest about that. It was kind of simple plays, get Kawhi the ball, get LaMarcus the ball. But then at least they can ping it around and they have good passers after that and good decision makers in a way that Oklahoma City doesn't necessarily, to where they can make you pay for overhelping. And one of those plays, West got the ball on the baseline and threw it right back up top to LaMarcus, who then was able to drive and get fouled. That was just a great immediate touch pass, the type of play that the supporting players on OKC just are unable or have not been put in position to make.
I don't know if you have a specific opinion on this, but what did you think of the whistle in this game?
It was fine either way.
I thought it was a little tight on the Spurs, but not horrible. I thought there were a few plays that were a little bit marginal that got called against San Antonio, but nothing like egregious or criminal.
Yeah, San Antonio shot 34 free throws to 20 for Oklahoma City. Yeah. LaMarcus and Kawhi shot 24 free throws between them. But I think other than just the one where that was kind of a pre-call where LaMarcus got Ibaka quote-unquote in the air, but he wasn't even in the air, and then Ibaka moved forward 3 inches, and LaMarcus moved forward about 2 feet, jumping into him to draw the supposed foul. Other than that, I didn't think there were any too egregious. The Spurs had a lot of plays that also kind of looked like travels, maybe, but none of them were just like absolutely obvious. And I think when it comes to traveling, you kind of limit it to the really obvious calls.
Oh, how did you not bring up the Russell Westbrook thing, which we'll maybe talk about with LeBron, of the Euro foul attempting the 3-pointer and getting 3 free throws?
Oh yeah. Yeah, that was really probably my 2 least favorite things, the field contact on the perimeter and throw it up for a shooting foul, and then the Euro foul. But in thinking about it, I think the Euro foul is worse. So I was glad that the Euro foul got punished. But now, of course, what we're going to see is the fake Euro foul causing someone to try to get, the Lou Will field contact and throw it up for a 3-pointer 40 feet from the basket. And, it's going to be this continuing cat and mouse game.
But Andre Iguodala is going to be the first guy to do a fake on it. I'm pretty confident.
Yeah, these guys all watch each other's games at this point at the time of year. And you know that someone saw that and they're going to start trying. I mean, Chris Paul, of course, tried it for years. He tried it in Oklahoma City, but he never actually got the shot off. He just got it stripped. And the refs, those are the first 2 times I've ever seen a shooting foul actually called in those situations. But in both of them, they really started it early. By the technical definition, it probably was a shooting foul if you see the guy coming to foul you. Anyway, that's probably more ink than that deserves. Couple other thoughts down the end. On that Kawhi offensive rebound, Russ was just shot out of a cannon, running in behind Kawhi to knock it away from him. And I don't know how Kawhi felt him there. I thought that was going to be a sure steal. And Kawhi somehow managed to protect the ball from him and probably sent him a nice little elbow, too, and protected it. And then, was able to hit some of the icing free throws. I mean, losing that offensive rebound, that would have been their chance to go up or to go and get a chance to tie. They never actually had the ball with the chance to tie after that. And then the next time down, I talked about how the Spurs were all over the ATOs. We've remarked many times, going back to that game with the Clippers, that one of Donovan's favorites is, to set a pin down for KD, have him catch the ball coming up to the top, and then a flare screen for Russ. And San Antonio was all over it. They wouldn't let KD catch the ball once he finally did. The timing was all off on the flare screen. Someone was right there. And then they ended up having to go for a Deion Waiters banked in two after wasting 14 of the 20 remaining seconds. And then at that point, the game was over. So it was, they tried to go for the three.
Sorry, and they'd already wasted 5 seconds after Kawhi got the rebound, realizing what happened that they had to foul.
Yeah, that's understandable because you got to look at the clock first, see what the differential is.
That's true.
At that point, I mean, the shot clock was still on, but there was like a 1 second differential. It takes you a little bit of a second to process that, like, okay, we got a foul there. So I didn't think that was too terrible.
Yeah, I think it was just more in conjunction with the time it took. That was like combined about 15 seconds, I think.
I think that's about all I've got on this game. I mean, I guess we should talk about the future of the series now. This one, I mean, I always say that if you are the road team, if you are really serious about winning the series, you need to be up 3-1 after the fourth game because you only have one more at home. And the record of teams tied 2-2 when one team has home court advantage is not very good, you know, for the road team. And so OKC losing this one, I mean, even if they win on Sunday, they still are not in great position in this series. They really were able to, you know, I mean, the good news is that they played with San Antonio just fine. Like, this is a series that blowout in game one seems like the aberration now, but they are still back to being massive underdogs, probably, you know, 80% chance, if not more, that the Spurs win the series now.
I always treat it that the team without home court needs to assume that they have to win in six. While, of course, you can win in seven, that you operate that way, and that would mean at this point that Oklahoma City would have to win the next three. And I was talking actually with some people who are more connected with the Warriors about, and they were talking about the result being positive for the Warriors, and what I said is I disagreed with that because I personally feel that Oklahoma City is more likely to, or sorry, San Antonio is more likely to win another game in Oklahoma City than Oklahoma City is in San Antonio.
Last thing, shout out to Seth Curry for agreeing with me that hand checking in the old NBA wasn't that bad, and that the emphasis on calling it is kind of over, because if you really watch, they are not just calling any contact on the perimeter the way they did back in, you know, 2005, 2006. I mean, the emphasis now is on calling, I think, the least amount that you can in a lot of situations. So scoring is just fine without calling every single hand check, and I think that it's just it's totally over. I mean, I watched a game from 1990, Bulls versus Sixers, in which Jordan had 45 points and Stacey King had 23, and Ed Neely with 9 points and 9 rebounds was the Miller Lite player of the game, because America really needed a certain type of basketball hero back at that point. But it was in watching that game, this whole hand checking was like so incredibly hard, blah blah blah. The hand checking really was not that bad. Like, it was like you didn't see people just getting like knocked off their path every time they tried to drive by a hand check.
Yeah, it was there were certain guys that were adept at using it, but other than that, it was less prevalent than some people probably remember it.
This is a total nerd note, but that Sixers team with basically Barkley and absolutely nobody else was like, I think, a top 30 team in offensive rating in NBA history. That's how good Barkley was as an offensive player back then. Just amazing usage, like well over 60 true shooting percentage. He was a great, great offensive player back then.
Oh, actually, that leads into a question. This was something I think it was when I was talking with Tim Bontemps about, do you think Barkley is the best player in NBA history to never win a title, or would you give it to Stockton?
No, I'd go to Karl Malone.
Oh, okay.
Elgin Baylor would have to be up there. Yeah. Karl Malone, when you consider his longevity as well, and you know the fact that defense is part of NBA basketball, which Charles Barkley is not, it's not really something that he particularly appreciated. I would say, yeah, I mean, Malone, Malone was great until he was like 39, 40. Like, he wasn't amazing in big moments at times in the finals when he got there, but he had also some pretty massive playoff runs as well. So off the top of my head, he would be the guy who comes to mind for me.
And we're talking about it in the context of if Durant theoretically got into that conversation. I mean, I think we all hope that he does better than that, but if he does, then I think then he probably moves ahead of those kind of guys, depending on longevity.
I'm not ready to say that. If he plays really well until age 40, then you can tell me that he's better than
Look at you. Karl Malone. Look at you, so conservative. I'm not criticizing.
Karl Malone's longevity was unbelievable. It was like crazy how good he was able to be for that long. And part of that was because the league was watered down as he got into his 30s. But nonetheless, I mean, he won an MVP in 1997 at like 33 and another one at like 35 in 1999. All right, let's move on to our friends at SeatGeek. SeatGeek is my go-to for getting tickets of any stripe, particularly to sporting events. And the reason for that are threefold. One, they tell you all of the fees up front. You don't go through, select your tickets, get to pay, and all of a sudden there are these undisclosed fees on there like there are for StubHub sometimes. Also, SeatGeek aggregates together all the ticket buying options, so you have a ton at your fingertips. You don't have to check a bunch of different sites, worry that maybe you're missing out on a deal. SeatGeek is going to put them in front of you. And the third, of course, is that you can get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. SeatGeek will send it to you after you make it using the CapSpace code, all one word, and of course easy to remember because we talk about CapSpace all the time here on the program. That's the code for all of our sponsors. So download that SeatGeek app, go into the settings tab, click add a promo code, enter the CapSpace code, and SeatGeek will send you your $20 after you make your first purchase. They are the inaugural sponsor. Great company. Know a lot of people there. They're fantastic, and they're the best way to buy and sell tickets.
And if you want to see a game of Cavs Hawks, you're probably going to need to use SeatGeek to go to Game 4.
I have a feeling that there may actually be quite a few tickets available for that now. If any Cleveland fans want to take the trip down, because the Hawks are done.
They have breached Fortress Phillips.
Yeah, just like they did for the first two games last year. You know, this is just, Atlanta played well for a little while. They had at least a good offensive game for most of it. Cleveland was kind of going through the motions here, I think, which dated back to the second half of game two, in which, you know, was mostly consumed with going for the three-point record. The Hawks, 16 out of 34 on threes. They shot amazingly. Korver was 5 out of 9. You know, Horford, 2 out of 4. And Cephalosha even hit a couple with LeBron not guarding him at all. But they still just are not a tough enough team to beat Cleveland's. Cleveland has a pretty fantastic combination of guys who are really skilled and can drain threes. They were 21 out of 39 in this game. And the Hawks' strategy, again, gave up a crap load of three-pointers. And not only that combination of being able to get up that many threes, make that many threes, and then also get 18 of the 40 available rebounds on the offensive glass, that's not something that you see very often. And this is just really the perfect storm with this three-point shooting and offensive rebounding team combined with a Hawks team that gives up a ton of threes and gives up a ton of offensive rebounds.
And also, Cleveland, when they need to, they can play pretty good defense. I don't think they really locked in on that end for the first three quarters, but in the fourth quarter, Atlanta just couldn't get anything.
Channing Frye was the big story in this one, and he and Love, we saw the first extended minutes for he and Love in the front court. We had said before, or at the trade deadline, that would be an absolutely unstoppable offensive lineup. That proved to be the case. They just killed them. Frye was 7-9 from three. His high, quick release was a big problem for Atlanta, and he had 27 points on 13 shooting possessions. So every time he shot, he scored more than 2 points.
That's good.
Incredible. And his plus minus was 28 in his 28 minutes, which I'm pretty sure is a high for him with the Cavs.
And it coincided, well, it was a counter to something that Atlanta had tried in this game, which was aggressively trapping pick and rolls. And you can aggressively trap pick and rolls when Tristan Thompson is involved because he's not really that kind of a threat. But when Channing Frye or Kevin Love is involved, you're conceding an open three for a guy who's quite good at it.
Yeah, and the Cavs do a nice job of spacing the floor out. They run a lot of those pick and pops where you have the shooter actually going to the corner for a three, where it is very, very difficult to get another guy over to help. So you're basically, you got to get him with one of the two guys involved in the action. And I thought it's a great strategy to trap when it's Thompson, although it's hard to do that on LeBron because he can see over the defense and he's not going to kind of have to loop a pass over the two defenders the way someone, you know, who's a shorter point guard might have to do to allow people to recover. And he can kind of get it to Thompson moving towards the basket, say at the free throw line instead of the top of the key. But nonetheless, they had success on those plays, I thought. And forcing Thompson to make a decision. He was only 1 out of 6. He missed some floaters. He did, of course, have 9 offensive rebounds, and Kevin Love had 4. That's not good for the Hawks. But, yeah, I mean, for Frye especially, and then a lot of it, too, was spot-ups. You know, they started Cephalosha in this one, brought Korver off the bench. I thought Cephalosha did okay on LeBron, but you're still, LeBron was able to pretty much back down, force help, or, you know, just get a layup when they weren't going to help because they were so worried about the shooting. Kyrie, another incandescent three-point shooting game for him. He was 4 out of 5. He had a really nice run when LeBron was out of the game to sort of continue bringing them back in the end of the third quarter. And then once LeBron came in, it was all over, and they just destroyed them. I think 34 to 16 was the final closing run for Cleveland.
Yeah, it was a really dominant performance that closed the door, because early on, what was really helping Atlanta was this crazy double where whenever Cleveland got the ball, they scored, but they turned the ball over so much. And this was the same thing I believe that happened at parts of game two, that they were keeping Atlanta in the game. But the difference between this and game two was that Atlanta was hitting all their shots, and so they were able to do it. Kevin Love scored the first 13 points for the Cavs and got embarrassed twice, but still played a pretty good game overall.
Yeah, he'll have a couple, you know, Chris Humphreys crossed him up. He got dunked on by Al Horford in pretty nasty fashion. But Love will execute the system. You know, they've defended reasonably well with him on the court. They've been a top 10-ish defense most of the year. And, you know, with Millsap and Horford, those guys are pretty good at stopping the initial action sometimes. But Millsap had 5 defensive rebounds in 39 minutes, and Horford had 1 defensive rebound in 31 minutes. And so their starting front court had 6 defensive rebounds, and the starting front court for the Cavs, in way less minutes as well, had 13 offensive rebounds. Just, you cannot deal with that. And you know, this is an NBA that has eschewed the offensive rebound. The Hawks were right up there with one of the worst offensive rebound rates in NBA history this year, but the Cavs have not, and that is big trouble for the rest of the East, specifically this Cavs team.
Yeah, specifically the Hawks. But it's going to be a...
Yeah, thank you.
It's going to be a challenge, I would say, in the next round, just because what Cleveland forces you to do, because they have these bigs that can, some of them can shoot and they can crash the offensive boards, is that you have to make some really tough choices. And a lot of times the best answer to that is having big men who have agility. And agility is not something you necessarily think of with Jonas Valanciunas.
Yeah, or Hassan Whiteside, for that matter, getting out to the three-point line. It'd be very interesting to see. And the other thing, too, is that, you know, Whiteside with Thompson, is he going to just stick to Thompson and then, like, not be the help force that he can be? Or with Fry, you know, is he going to be able to actually get out on a pick and pop with Fry, you know, or, like, not allow Kyrie Irving to shoot a mid-range jumper? We'll see who they end up playing, obviously. I mean, obviously, this series is over. A couple of more little notes from this game. LeBron, people were saying his jumper is back after 4 of 6 on threes. In the last game, he was 1 out of 4. Did have a couple of jump shots that he was able to hit, though, on catch and shoots. One of them was just where he kind of held it in an ISO and then just shot it without putting it on the floor. Another one was the catch and shoot three. That's a big reason why his three-pointer has gone south with Cleveland, because he actually used to get a lot of catch and shoot threes when he was in Miami with other guys starting the action. And, you know, Kyrie, not exactly really a guy who is fantastic at setting those up for James. But, you know, he because when he's off the dribble, he just has more of a tendency to fade, get off balance. When you're just standing there and jumping, you can jump more straight up and down. Jeff Teague was fantastic throughout most of the game, finished with 19 points and 14 assists. But in the fourth quarter, when Cleveland really turned up the defense, he really had a tough time of it and started kind of throwing the ball away, wasn't able to hit shots as well when they went under on the pick and roll. And, you know, I mean, a lot of what this series came down to, as we talked about in game two, is just that the Cavs shooters were better than Atlanta's. And I mean, even when Atlanta went crazy, as they did in this game, they still weren't able to get over the top.
Cleveland is just a terrible matchup for Atlanta. And Kevin Pelton said it yesterday, I said it today. You have to wonder about the effects of Atlanta losing the last game of the regular season. They probably didn't think it was going to matter because Miami was going against Boston. They had a lot of incentive to win. Miami loses that game. So that means that if Atlanta had beaten Washington, who was dead in the water, long time, a couple of weeks, like a week before.
John Wall didn't play. And eventually had surgery.
And I think Beal either played limited minutes or didn't play at all, but that's off the top of my head.
Yeah.
And if Atlanta wins that game, they get the 3 seed, Miami gets the 6, and that would have been a real tough first round series for them, but I think they would have had a decent shot. Then they avoid Cleveland for another round, and what I think is really concerning is when you think about that one of their best players is up as an unrestricted free agent this year, is this is a really bad way to lose if you're trying to sell somebody on your future.
Yeah, it's not like, oh man, you know, we lost in 6. If we'd been healthy, or, you know, just a couple breaks went our way, like, come back, we can really do it next time. We got another $15 million in cap space with your cap hold, Al Horford. Now, if they're willing to step up with the full 5-year max, then, you know, with him being age 30, he probably will stay. That's going to be a bad contract by the end of it, though. I don't know if the Hawks are going to want to do that. So it'll be really interesting to see what happens there, whether Horford, you know, if the bunny is the same between the Hawks and somewhere else, whether he eventually decides to give it another shot with somewhere else to win. But we'll have a lot more talk about that, obviously, as well. Yeah, that's about it. I mean, we'll have a post-mortem on the Hawks a little bit later on, but Cavs going to the next round, we probably won't even talk that much about this game on Sunday, unless it ends up being like really close for the Hawks somehow win or something. But you have to imagine that they are they're going to be pretty well defeated at this point.
It's the least interesting game of the weekend as of now.
All right, I want to do a little announcement on behalf of myself, and because I'm going to be a speaker this summer at the Vegas Summer League Sports Business Classroom. I'm actually going to be joining Larry Kuhn, who I'm happy enough to say has been a bit of a mentor to me, in a deep dive on the NBA salary cap. We'll have more details about that coming up for sure. He'll probably hope to have him on soon and to just talk a lot of cap stuff, but also as well to talk about the Sports Business Classroom. But the website, if you want to check it out and learn a little bit more on how to register, is sportsbusinessclassroom.com. So go ahead and check it out. We'll have much more details on that coming up, but certainly would be honored if any Dunked On listeners were to attend that. Let's get some news. What we got?
Well, you want to start with Blake Griffin? I guess that's probably a good place, because Blake Griffin, what wasn't the news is that he's going to miss the Olympics. It's the general timetable of his return.
Yeah, and this was reported, it was sort of sitting down here in our news items for a little bit ago by Kevin Ding, that the procedure he was going to need was this bone marrow procedure to repair his left quad tendon. The language in the release was that he will hopefully be ready for next season, but Ding's reporting said basically that Blake played knowing that he could re-tear it or injure it worse, and that the procedure would have a 4 to 6 month recovery. And we talked about it with John Wall, we talked about it with Anthony Davis, but especially for guys like Blake and Wall, who really need to work on their shooting, work on their game, not being able to work out this summer is a problem. And Blake's a guy also who, you know, it's really important for him to get into great shape from a cardio standpoint. You know, that's something that might be a little bit more difficult for him as well. So I had made the point that I thought, you know, Blake's time as a real true superstar, you know, top 10 player in this league is kind of over to me until further notice. And this makes it less likely that he can get back to this level.
And the other major factor with this is that it makes it very, very unlikely that he gets traded at any point in the near future, just because that's way too much risk to take on, coupled with the fact that he will be an unrestricted free agent after next season, I think he has an ETO technically, but it doesn't really make a difference. So he'll be a free agent, you know, in 2017. And so you have a guy who is going to have to really recover, and you're getting a lot less value. You're getting less than one probably regular season and total of one playoffs if they choose to trade him at all.
And next year now is going to be a huge one for him in terms of establishing value, right? Like, his maximum will start probably around $30 million next year, depending on what happens with the new CBA. Is he going to command a full five-year deal for starting at $30 million? That's going to be, you know, what, $170 million or something, all told? Is he going to play well enough to do that, where you want to sign him to that deal at age 28 through 32? You know, he's got a lot on the line to play well next year now, and it's going to be, kind of difficult for him to get a start there. The Jazz, on the other hand, have signed a long-term extension with Quinn Snyder. That's all that we know about the terms of the deal, but certainly deserved with Quinn Snyder. He has been great over these 2 years, and probably a smart move to lock him up. I would imagine that he will get a fairly decent raise, but we'll see whether it even ever comes out. I'm sure the Jazz will want to kind of keep it quiet, much as the Spurs do. You know, Dennis Lindsay is from that Spurs school, and so is Quinn, on what Greg Popovich makes and how long his contract is and blah, blah. So, but good for the Jazz to lock him up, especially with, you know, some of the other kind of coach expiring contract situations that we've seen. What else do we have?
Well, so it sounds like Jeremy Lin, in the least surprising move of the summer, is going to opt out of his super cheap 2016-17 player option.
Yeah, he signed, as you'll remember, for just the room exception essentially last
year. Wasn't it the biannual?
Oh, yeah, you know what? You're right. It was. Yeah, it wasn't even the room exception. They didn't use cap room last year. Incredibly low. He had a player option for this year. I think he's someone who could get up to maybe $10 million a year, depending. If people are talking about more, I think that would be a pretty massive overpay, even in the new environment. We'll see. But it'll be a challenge for Charlotte to retain him, because he hasn't been on the team long enough for really good bird rights that they can use on him to kick in. You know, basically the only thing they can pay him without using cap room is 120% of his prior salary. And so they're essentially going to have, I think, about $12 million left over once you consider the cap holds of Courtney Lee and Nicola Batum to sign Williams, Al Jefferson, and Lynn. And so that's that could be pretty difficult. And I think Marvin Williams would be a bigger priority than Lynn would be. He's a lot less replaceable, but, you know, could also demand more on the marketplace. So even if Charlotte, just all they want to do is bring the band back together, and they are willing to overpay to do so, they may not even be able to, even in that circumstance.
Oh, one other small thing that we haven't mentioned in a while is that Kristaps Porzingis said in a press conference that he will not play in the Olympics, which is a little bit sad, just because it would have been fun to see him. But, you know,
yeah,
I think
they actually Latvia is only in the Olympic qualifying tournament.
Right.
You know, they, I forget what group they're in, but even with him, they would not be favorites to advance out of any group. And so, you know, I think if they were actually had already qualified for the Olympics, he probably would play, but just to play in the tournament, the qualifying tournament, it probably isn't worth it for him when, you know, the Knicks really kind of want him to stick around and work on his game. Other Knicks news, Phil Jackson is going on a tweeting tour of the Midwest en route to his cabin in Montana. That has ignited quite the firestorm from the New York media that they still don't have a coach and he's just kind of messing around, you know, that he's not evaluating draft prospects. This is his second vacation in 6 weeks, blah, 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 blah. And then, you know, it was leaked that they supposedly contacted Frank Vogel's agent. Do you see that happening in New York? I feel like it is not something that Phil Jackson would be interested in.
As long as he's in control, it doesn't sound like something he would push for at all.
I mean, and you think all the reporting is he really wants Rambis and he really wants to run the triangle. I mean, other than Brian Shaw, there really isn't anyone else out there to run the triangle. And I'm guessing that if there is a discussion, he apparently just had lunch with David Blatt a couple weeks ago, and there hasn't really been any forward movement on that. I'm guessing Blatt was not particularly interested in running the triangle either. And so maybe Jackson is just, quote-unquote, doing his due diligence, having these discussions, finding out that none of these coaches know or want to run the triangle, and then he can go back to James Dolan and say, see, there's no one else. It's got to be Rambis.
It's got to be Rambis. That can be the title of the episode when they rehire him.
We still haven't heard anything on Dell Demps' future in New Orleans. Supposedly, according to Justin Verrier, that is because the NFL draft has been going on, and of course, the Pelicans and Saints are inextricably intertwined. But, you know, I think really, if Demps is going to not be retained, you're doing draft workouts, you're trying to get someone else in who would want to have a staff before he would have to do the draft and free agency and what is obviously an extremely, extremely important summer for the Pels, both with their draft pick and with whether to retain free agents, try to bring someone else in, as this is really, you know, their chance to build around it. AD, maybe get another star in there with this lottery pick. So, you know, they basically wasted almost a month now after the end of the season. If they end up not retaining him, that really doesn't make much sense.
Yep, it's a big problem.
Let's talk a little bit about the awards that already came down.
Yeah, we're still waiting on two for some reason, but yeah, let's start with most improved player. CJ McCollum was I think, even though you didn't have him as your pick to win it, like to deserve it, I think we both expected him to win.
Yeah, and he's totally fine. When you consider the type of candidates that have won it before, you would have to say that he would have been the logical pick. I had him third on my ballot behind Curry and Kawhi. And I guess, you know, it's kind of fair that it should go to a little bit of a lesser player just because, you know, the MVP is Curry. You know, if you're really like a total superstar, winning most improved, you know, kind of doesn't necessarily make a ton of sense. So it's good to have an award. You know, the point of it is for have something that young players can kind of shoot for. And, you know, improvement is really the name of making yourself a great player.
And McCollum actually improved as opposed to the guys who get it just by playing more minutes.
Yeah, and you could make the argument that he was like sort of at this level in the playoffs, but he hadn't done it over a large enough sample size where you can say that, you know, he was anywhere close to as good as this year. I had a little bit more of a problem, as you might guess, with the next award.
Our good friend Jamal Crawford won Sixth Man of the Year, and it was ludicrous just because the value he provided to his team was so much lower than a lot of different guys. I mean, even if you wanted to go for an offense-only swingman, I wouldn't have chosen Jamal Crawford.
Yeah, we talked about this ad nauseum before. I mean, I think I had a long rant on this, you know, right before the end of the regular season, basically that, you know, Andre Iguodala, who at least got second, is just a better player than Jamal Crawford. He makes more money for a reason. Every coach in the league would rather have Iguodala than Crawford. But, you know, Crawford is very popular, and he definitely, you know, is a great guy, to be sure. And even, like, thanked every media member who voted for him and stuff. But he's just not that good. That's all it is at this point.
And while we're talking about dynamic, effusive personalities, Kawhi Leonard won Defensive Player of the Year.
Yeah, deserved. We both had him. I am be interested to see, you know, with the way Draymond has defended so far in the playoffs, whether, I mean, it's been those two guys for the last 2 years is like clearly the best. And, you know, I think we'll see them just fight it out for who's the best defensive player, hopefully in the Western Conference Finals.
Yeah, well, we'll see.
Steve Kerr, Coach of the Year. And I, again, have no problem with this one. I actually said Luke Walton on my ballot. I didn't know how to deal with the whole, these guys, you know, neither one coached the entire year. I think a lot of the people who voted for Kerr in an argument that I probably didn't give enough to just that he is the one who was there behind the scenes. He created this culture. Coaching is not necessarily just a one season award for a lot of these guys. And, you know, without the work that he had done, they wouldn't have had the 39-4 start. And obviously he was great as well. And it's probably the best way to really reward this amazing season. I had Popovich. I would have had Kerr if he had coached the whole year. And so I got no problem with him winning. I think that he is, in my opinion, either the first or second best coach in the league. And congratulations to him after, you know, and there have been some great pieces written about what he really had to go through personally this year with, you know, the headaches and the health problems that he's had that I recommend you guys read. Tim Kawakami had a good one on that. So, yeah, and who was that? Was Pop second?
I think Pop was second. The other piece, I'm really sad and frustrated with myself that I don't remember, that I don't have the name of it, but there was a piece that was written that just won an award. This is why I was thinking about it. It won an award for the best newspaper article of its type that was written for a circulation.
Oh, yeah, from like San Jose.
I think Mercury. It was San Jose Mercury News, but I can't remember the name of the author. But it's about Kerr's, the personal tragedy he went through with his dad, which is a story that we don't need to tell in this space. But I'll link to it on Twitter, I'll put it on my Facebook page as well, that I would encourage you all to read it. Just give some context into what the kind of life he's had before this, too.
All right, we'll probably be back on Sunday, unless one of tomorrow's games is just such a classic that we have to do an emergency podcast. But most likely Sunday, we'll talk about all four series and any news that arises. As far as plugs, Danny invited me to do a Q&A with The Athletic, which is a subscription site, but pretty cheap. It's like $4 a month.
And I think that article is free also, I believe.
Yeah, that article is free. So check that out. It is, I'm sure Danny has a link to it. And that was just a Q&A on kind of what the Warriors should do going forward in the rest of the series and kind of where they're at right now. And then what else do you have?
I wrote a preview of Game 3 for The Athletic, which is up now. And then also, Real Jam Radio this week was with Derek Bodner, who writes for Philadelphia Magazine, USA Today, and Draft Express. We talked a lot about the Sixers, and then we talked about the draft as well. It was a really fun conversation.
Do you have anything interesting to say about the draft that people wouldn't have expected?
Well, he really likes Luau. He has him fifth on his board, which I'm sure Raptors fans don't want the fifth pick, but the idea, but just the of how he could fit in with this team, and also
Sixers fans don't want the fifth pick.
Yes, Sixers fans don't want the sixth pick, but the idea of him being kind of like a defensive and ideally a 3-and-D guy. And we talked about, you know, the idea of Simmons versus Ingram and just basically that his offensive ceiling, and I think we both kind of agree on this, his offensive ceiling is so high that even though there are these big risk factors that you need to think about physically and mentally, that you just can't pass on that kind of a talent unless your team already has a guy who can be your offensive engine.
Yeah, I'm really excited to get into the draft this year, which I probably will do once we don't have two games a night to analyze in great detail. We'll obviously start doing as well off-season previews, in addition to probably going through maybe the top 10 or 15 guys with some scouting reports, and obviously we'll have some good guests on to talk about the draft as well as it gets up to that time. But enough about the future. We'll talk to you all on Sunday night. Till then.